For those listening to KSBN Money Talk Radio who might be interested in buying physical precious metals for less than what I can pay for them, stay tuned. I have a way you can support this show and secure what I believe is the best price for precious metals on the existing market. In our first commercial break, I will explain this in more detail. And now, let's get on with reclaiming the Republic. Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. If you go to MobiusStripPress.com, you can find out how you can download these podcasts and find our support documents and links. This show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. This is G.R. Mobley, and the number to call in if you want to join the conversation or you have questions, that number will be, and it's toll-free, 844-320-4299. This is also an educational grassroots program. It's designed to restoring our republic the way the framers had intended and placing the general government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution. So many parts of these shows will refer to previous parts and cross-reference and so forth. And so I build off of each other's shows, and consequently, you'll need to listen to all of these shows to garner what Reclaiming the Republic is and Republic Review and how we can reclaim the Republic. So don't forget to download the podcasts at ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I also want to, before I get started in a monologue and get into more of the foundation of the show, I want to offer a contest. I've got a set of books. My first book, which is We the People, Whose Constitution Is It Anyway? A Constitutional Fix to a Constitutional Problem. That's the first book. And the second book is We the People, The Strategy to Convene a Convention for Republic Review. I have both of those books here, and I would offer them to anybody that can call in, and I'll give you the number again. But I offer them to anybody who can call in and tell me what the constitutionality or significance of the constitutionality for us regarding November 11th. Last November 11th, this coming November 11th, what is the significance, the constitutional significance of November 11th? Anybody call in, I'm offering a set of my books. And I'm doing this because I actually covered this on the ACN network when I was broadcasting last year up until the end of January this year. And so most people that had listened to that show or my previous shows would be able to go, ah, I know what he's talking about. So anyway, I also want to kind of put out an olive branch. And if you've heard my commercials and spots regarding the Republican, Libertarian, and Constitutional parties, I'm offering an olive branch, or I'm trying to create a mechanism, be a network or an appliance to allow these parties to start working together, because in this community, it is so divided between these different parties. And again, they only are divided on a very small fraction of the issues. They usually all agree on the principles of individual sovereignty, individual liberty. And if we can get them to start working together and we can clean up a lot of our public offices, we'll actually be able to get people that are serving us, the people, instead of serving themselves and serving other ideologies that are countering and the antithesis of individual liberty and individual sovereignty. So hopefully in the future, I will be able to either report, work with, and even have them on the show so they can start talking about what they're doing and how they're going to have big impacts regarding our upcoming elections. Also, before I get started into the dialogue of what the foundation of this show is, I received an email. And to paraphrase, the listener was asking me, what is the relevance of Reclaiming the Republic? We got Donald Trump in. We've got, you know, a trifecta in the federal government. Why do we need to worry about reclaiming the republic? Well, we've had trifectas before, and we've had supposedly great leaders before. I can go back to Ronald Reagan. Not once did Ronald Reagan diminish the size, nor did he have the power to diminish the size of the federal government. So I'm going to continue to educate people until we can start seeing these unconstitutional departments go away. And these unconstitutional departments, I'll list them for you. It was the Department of Justice, Interior, Agriculture, Commerce, Labor, Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, Transportation, Energy, Education, Veterans Affairs, and Homeland Security. Every single one of those are usurpations of the state's powers, state's rights. And until the states ratify a constitutional amendment granting and delegating those powers, as I've said before, these roles, responsibilities, and powers, or what I call RRPs, are all unconstitutional because the states have not delegated that. So the money that they're spending on the Department of Interior, buying people's homes so that the federal government can own it, occupy it, and manage it, and so forth, all of that is unconstitutional spending. And if we don't understand the impact of that, it adds up into our debt. So go look at the debt clock and tell me why we would care about spending money we shouldn't be spending. Or allowing some of these agencies, if you haven't been following the news, how they have been draconian and thug-like in how they treat we the people. So I don't think that, you know, in any direction on many of these departments, you can consider them a true public service, nor would I ever think that it would be a good idea to amend the Constitution to grant these types of powers to a federal government that is supposed to defend us from foreign enemies and invasions and those types of things. And they're doing a bad job at that. And okay, I'll give Trump his credit that he's trying to stop some of that. But if he would just use the Constitution as his shield and his weapon, then I would probably be a little bit quieter and a little more focused on getting these done, or at least getting these departments dismantled. And this is only the departments. There's over 500, just under 600, last time I counted, departments or agencies, offices, and administrations like the EPA and so forth. If you go on to the federalgov.website, and actually, if you want to know where it is, or I can give you the list, it's just unconscionable that they have that many roles, responsibilities, and powers that they've granted to themselves. Anyway, last week I mentioned that we were the 100,000th club, and I didn't go into the details of this, but I do want to clarify and elucidate this club for you that you're joining through education. And that is, if you understand what 1% of the population is, that's 3 million some odd people. 1/100,000% of the population is probably how many people really understand the hard limits, the defined scope of the Constitution, and the fact that it is a contract that has been given to the states and owned by the states. The states are the stakeholders, for those who like buzzwords that or a trigger word that gets them hot and bothered, because a lot of people get upset when I use the word stakeholder. But the states are the stakeholders of this contract. They're the ones that have the power, and I'm going to get into the common knowledge that was discussed several times in the Federalist Papers. Hopefully that'll be next week, if not the following. But let me repeat this. These 12 departments that I just listed, from Justice down to Homeland Security, they are unconstitutional because they have not been amended to the contract, and that contract has a very specific process. That process is the Article 5 process, where two-thirds, it's not just a majority vote in Congress, two-thirds of both houses, both the House and the Senate, have to pass an amendment that they feel worthy to send out to the states so that we can delegate them this power. They have to approve it by two-thirds, and then it goes out to the states. They provide a courtesy copy to the White House, but the White House has no involvement in this until it becomes law, and then it's another thing that the president has to faithfully execute. Madison and the framers referred several times in the discussion and the explanations of the Constitution that this is a contract. It is a compact. Those words are interchangeable. The fact that Article 7 in the Constitution even exists acknowledges the fact that it requires states as stakeholders. The states had to have buy-in. It didn't cost them anything, but they had to agree to submit these limited powers to the federal government. And by doing so, the federal government becomes supreme in those specific powers alone. Well, I'm done on this segment because I'm up on a hard break and I hear the music. So I will be right back and we'll get into more of this constitutional discussion. Thank you. All right, so I can't hear myself. Okay, so now I can hear myself. And if I can't hear myself, I can't even think. Before the break, I was talking about Article 7 in the Constitution that clearly delineates how the Constitution is a contract just by the mere fact that that article exists, because it requires the states to have buy-in. It is a contract that doesn't require cost, but it requires a submission. And so when the states buy into the Constitution, they delegate those powers to the federal government. And those few powers that they do delegate, the federal government is supreme in those powers. Those powers being national security, immigration. And if you go through Article 1, Section 8, that's where all those powers are enumerated. And it's very limited and defined to those powers only. The only other powers that the general government or the federal government actually possesses are those powers that we have delegated to them through amendments. And I challenge you to point out any amendment to the Constitution where we've granted any of these roles, responsibilities, or powers from the Justice Department down to the Homeland Security, that list of 12 executive departments that I go through. The other fact that proves the fact that this is a contract is the ratification debates. The term ratifying is the process of arguing, is the process of debating and elucidating, clarifying, and defining what this contract does. That's the ratification process. And the word ratification goes hand in hand with contract and contract law. Contracts are ratified. They are approved or rejected. And the ratification process is that process of whether they will approve or reject. Rhode Island, for example, did nothing. They didn't approve, they didn't reject until they felt enough pressure from the rest of the states that they finally and hastily accepted the Constitution, and they didn't even follow the constitutional process. There's a few states that didn't follow the ratification process. Anyway, at least what the Constitutional Convention asserted should be done in basically setting up a set of delegates to debate the Constitution. Rhode Island and a couple of states did not do that. Anyway, the ratification debates are not only just the arguments of what the Constitution is. If you understand contract law, and I've used this example before, but I like using it. If I had a contract with a landscaper and I said, Billy Bob, you're my landscaper and I want you to make my house the most beautiful house in all of the neighborhood. We want to have the gleaming front end of our community. And so I don't care what it takes. You do whatever you need to do. You make it, spare no cost. You do what you have to do to make my yard the most beautiful. Well, I go to work the next day, I come home, and when I walk into my home, I find Billy Bob's equipment everywhere inside, and all my furniture's gone, and it's in the backyard. And I call Billy Bob and I go, what the heck are you doing? And Billy Bob says, well, you said I could do whatever it took. And so it's a lot easier for me to just keep all of that equipment that I use to make your yard beautiful. You understand the importance of ensuring that there's no ambiguity in a contract. And so anybody that has ever written a contract understands you don't want to have any ambiguity. The framers and those who ratified didn't want any ambiguity. And that's why when you read the New York debates of the Constitution or the ratification process, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and so forth, we're talking hundreds of pages. It's a very difficult read, but I would challenge anybody to go read those things. And you'll actually find very interesting ways that each other puts each other down or calls each other names in their formality of being gentlemen of the day, where they call each other out for lying and so forth. But anyway, as they debated these things, the definitions that were provided, and who was providing these definitions to the states? Were the states interpreting the Constitution by itself? No. Who did they have at each of these ratification debates? They had the guys that actually wrote it, because the states sent delegates. I believe the state of Virginia sent 5 delegates, Madison, Randolph, Mason, and I forget the others. But nevertheless, they sent a number of delegates. I think New York sent 3, Hamilton being one. And so these delegates were at the convention of the debate or the ratification debates. And in this convention of the debate, they actually provided, and you can actually read the testimony that they provided in the limitations. I believe it was in the Federalist Papers and possibly also in the ratification debates, where they said that supremacy clause could be removed. It has no real force other than stating the obvious, that the supremacy clause only applies to those things that are enumerated. It doesn't grant any ambiguous power whatsoever, because the contract is specified. If the contract was wide open and saying, we're going to create this general government to do all sorts of good things and it will be supreme in all things it does, then that would be the ambiguity and that open door that they would be able to utilize. And so I'm going to go through, as a part of this show, I'm going to go through these documents. And as you listen to this, the epiphanies will constantly occur. Wow, I mean, how come I never read this in school? How come I didn't get this taught to me when I was going through college? I've found many lawyers that are completely unaware because they were never taught this. As a matter of fact, I have a book review of my first book by a lady that actually used to teach. She has a JD and she used to teach constitutional law and constitutional history. And she basically said that the way I laid my book out, this is the curriculum that she would use in teaching her classes of constitutional history and so forth, because it covers the full gamut from the very beginning of what individual liberty is and how they use that as a, and the founding principles. And W. Cleon Skousen talks about this in his book of the 5,000 Year Leap. He identifies 28 principles, and I actually build off of that, and I used and got his permission to cite those 28 principles. That being said, this first book that I've written, I clearly identifies the process that the framers went through in educating themselves and innovating a government that was never created before, a bicameral Congress, these checks and balances, and also the subserviency to the states. All other constitutional republics, Rome, Britain, Germany, and so forth, sovereignty was always restrained from the states once they created a federation or an administrative government, and they became the sovereigns, parliament, the king, and so forth. And the United States is the first government to actually give the final check, the final oversight, the final arbitrating power over the Constitution. That power was vested in the states and we, the people. So that's why it's really important for me to go through these things, because I don't want you to just take my word for it. I can talk really eloquently, or I can maybe dumb it down a little bit, but either way, I'm not trying to use this as a bully pulpit. This is an educational process where I'm still learning. There's lots of people that are great historians that get into the details and they get into the minutia over what had occurred here and what had occurred there. And I find that all fascinating. But in my perspective of history, you get lost when you go drilling down too far. And that's just due to the fact that you get so far into the weeds that you can't even see the forest through the trees. It's great if you're a micro historian, and most people really like the nuts and bolts of things. I prefer to take a macro perspective. Anyway, the contract, in the Article 5 process, which is in the Constitution, and as I've gone through this process, that it requires both houses of Congress, and I just can't believe my time is up already. Anyway, we're going to go through the conservative entertainers and the more of the Constitution as soon as we get back after this hard break. Thank you. Hey, as I was going through this contract information as far as the Article 7 as well as the ratification debates, I forgot to inject one thing. And I know I've mentioned this before, but there were also documents that were promulgated or distributed and disseminated out through the newspaper system. And they were called the Federalist Papers. And when Madison, Jay, and Hamilton started writing the Federalist Papers, there was a lot of dissension coming in from, I believe, Patrick Henry and a few others that were writing contrary comments. They were the anti-Federalists. And interestingly enough, they became Federalists after the Constitution was ratified, especially Patrick Henry. But the fact is that these ratification debates weren't standalone things. They were standalone for each state, but they were very harmonious amongst them. But more importantly, these Federalist Papers that were written by Jay, Hamilton, and Madison, those were actually telling the people and informing the people, creating pressure on those elected politicians, lawyers, or the gleaming class. And I've had this conversation with a few people that they thought that we, the people, were the ones that really ratified the Constitution. And if you go and look at those who attended and who signed off on the ratification debates, it was the who's who of the politicians of the time or the leaders of the time. The common folk were not up for election. The common person wasn't, you know, chosen by their peers. Most of these people were already well versed in the House of Burgess or what have you. And the ratification debates that were all signed, it wasn't signed by or it wasn't processed through a vote of the people. It was done by a representative government. They had Republican blood running, this little r Republican blood running through their veins. They were a representative people, and they had these people that they fully trusted. These people had their backs. They were noblemen, just like in the ancient days, or I should say ancient, but in the old days of England, the sheriff's position was a position of nobility. Most of those guys didn't make a salary, but they collected the taxes, and that's what the sheriff's job was in old England. Anyway, back onto the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers were additional arguments that were covering some of the things that didn't necessarily get weeded out in the ratification process because they were constantly bickering back and forth over what somebody was trying to say and what they meant to say and what they really said. Anyway, the Federalist Papers are what I'll actually get into first, and we'll get started on those as soon as I can, you know, lay this foundation. But as I go through these Federalist Papers, I will just bring out the highlights of those particular papers. And I have these out on Facebook as well, so you can always go read them and read them for yourself. It's always helpful to read and be informed and be able to cite and quote, because as you can talk at a academic or an educated level, it refutes those people that just think and believe in what they've been told, who can't cite anything. Oh, well, the federal government could do anything that they want to do. That's not true. The federal government can only do those things that we delegate to them, and anything that they're doing that we haven't is unconstitutional. So as I move forward and we get into this process of the Federalist Papers and the ratification debates and so forth, and create the argument that the federal government is truly limited, and it's not just me saying that, but there's multiple people saying that, then it seems like there's real relevance to this show. There's a real necessity to this show, because I truly do not believe that any of our elected officials are working to dismantle this Leviathan, this unconstitutional Leviathan, whether it's at the state level. And I will get into this later on in this show about the conventions of states and so forth, and the ludicrousy or the imbecility of some of these efforts. And they're just wasting our time. But what I want to kind of touch on right now, and I've talked to these before, we have a myriad, a plethora of conservative entertainers. And I love them all. I love listening to them because they just get my blood boiling, and that's what they're good at. But they don't, not one of them has a solution. And I would venture to say that if you look at the market space that some of these guys have, and I'll just mention a few names, Rush, Beck, Hannity, just to name a few, those guys make a lot of money. What would happen if all of a sudden we got the federal government back into the scope of the Constitution and everything was hunky-dory? Well, these guys would lose their show. There's a lot of money to be made on the division and all of these violations. And when somebody says, well, I'm willing to give up my millions of dollars, this dynasty that I have, and walk away from this, then okay, I'll believe you when you start supporting a real solution. But most of these guys, they want to call on a march and make you feel good that you rubbed elbows with people that feel the same way, but you do nothing. There has not been one department, one office, no agency, no building has turned off its lights. They're building more buildings, and this thing has been on a breakneck speed of growth and spending. That's why it's very important that we have a solution-based program, which is why I have this program, which is why I wrote my books. I don't care if I don't sell a million books, and I don't care if I don't make $1 million. As a matter of fact, if you have ever heard me speak, I talk about the importance that this can't be about money. The reason those other guys won't do anything is because money is involved. I'm not making billions of dollars, nor am I looking to make millions of dollars. What I'm looking to do is actually invoke change. And you are the ones that will help. Because if you agree with me that this shouldn't be happening, that we shouldn't have a welfare state, that we shouldn't have an intrusive government in our lives, that government doesn't have all the powers to do whatever it wants to do, and that the people are the fountain of the power of government, then we can pull that fountain back. And we can save ourselves from going off this brink. So when Rush, Hannity, and the rest of these guys start actually getting involved in a real solution, now there's a few of them that are supporting the There are a few conservative entertainers that are championing the Convention of States or the Article 5 Convention. Let me ask you this. What do we need another amendment for, or another set of words to give the federal government that's already ignoring all the words already? Do we really need to waste the time and energy in amending the Constitution now when our problem is compliance to the Constitution? As I've talked to people of the John Birch Society, constitutionalists, and so forth, when people come up to me, well, how do you feel about the Convention of States or the Article 5 Convention and this CONCON or whatever you want to spin it to? And I say it's just a waste of time. It's a complete waste of time, resources, and all of those are finite and valuable. We don't have a lot of time left. So what we have to do is we have to assemble and coalesce the states in, and if you read my executive summary, it's called auditing the Constitution, or what I call a convention for republic review. Yeah, it's a convention, just like a comic convention or a Star Trek convention. It's a body of people getting together with one sole purpose, and that sole purpose of the body of the states is not to amend the Constitution. It's not to rewrite the Constitution. It's not to create a new Constitution. It is to audit the Constitution and go through it line by line and say, where did we delegate you this power to execute this Department of Interior? That was the first department that they usurped in 1849. Where did we ratify an amendment granting you this power? During the Louisiana Purchase, when Jefferson was feeling pretty proud of himself for being able to buy that record-based, you know, territory for a small amount of money, considering what it's worth, even at the time, because we got pennies on the dollar on it, and he was pretty proud of the fact that he was able to do that, and he was able to do it constitutionally because it was a treaty. Yes, a treaty will allow, as long as you have 2/3 of the Senate approve it, they will allow a purchase of land. The problem is, and this was Madison's argument, that there's nowhere in the Constitution that the federal government can actually operate and own and possess that land. It is very defined to 10 nautical mile squares, or for very specific purposes and purposes only, and those purposes are listed in the Constitution. The Constitution does not grant them to own millions of acres to protect some bug and so forth. So I'm holding myself up in trying to move forward, and I hear music again, which means I'm up to another hard break. When I get back, I won't rant anymore on the sentiments of these conservative entertainers. I want to move forward at what we can do. I'll be right back. All right, let's get these conservative entertainers behind us. And I hear lots of people talking about the growing sentiments that we're winners, that the progressives are losers, and I'm not seeing it. I want to kind of go to the history or the record books, the annals here, and show me where we have won. We may have people in the positions. I was just talking to my producer, and he was telling me about how frustrated he is that we're not seeing any movement on the term limits. There seems to be a dragging of the feet of the change that all of these supposed Republicans or conservatives have, you know, rallied on and got us to vote for. The bottom line is that we have never seen a turning back of the progressivism that's been rammed down our throats, and it has been heaped upon us. And I'll give you some examples of that. A long time ago, they submitted that, you know, prayer in school was not necessary. There's been more evidence to prove that having religion involved, Christianity involved in the educational process, actually helps the behavior of individuals as they're growing up, because they have a moral compass and a moral guide. But the seculars would die, you know, in the streets. They would probably start buying guns and going to war if we started instituting and going back all of the things that they have been successful in implementing. Another thing that they've been able to do is they've been able to teach creation in school. I made this argument in my book that the secular progressives have successfully implemented a national secular church right underneath our nose, but they didn't have to build a building. They didn't have to appoint a prophet. The president in the last administration was the prophet, because as he edict that you will do these things, that you will not do these things, such as the edict with the education system forcing all schools to allow, you know, boys to be able to use girls' bathrooms and so forth. Don't tell me that that is not a religious function, because if you compare doctrines of creation versus evolution, there's a monopoly of the narrative going on in the school system. And if you go down the Christian doctrine, you just create a list of chasteness, morality, treating your body as a temple, you know, the types of doctrines that are taught within Christianity, you will find that there is the opposite of that being taught in the education system. Milton Friedman pointed this out in his book, Free to Choose, that the education system has been used as the Sunday school of the secular progressive. So but instead of calling it Sunday school, they call it Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday school. And they're getting away with actually countering any type of moral guidance and moral framework that is being done within the home and within the churches and communities. And they've been very successful at that. So who's really winning? I don't see any winning until we start taking back the ground that we gave up. And so getting intelligent design or creation as an opposing theory within school would be a good start. Prayer back in school, using the Bible in school, that would be a good start. Another argument is in the evolution fact was the Miller-Urey experiment back in the 50s, where these guys conducted an experiment where they injected electrical pulses into an environment where they had, you know, the clay and so forth, and they were able to create a protein goo that was the foundation for cells to be utilized for forming life. The problem is that's all they can create. They can create the hardware. The hardware has always existed within our world, but the software doesn't, and that software being the DNA. You can create the hardware for a computer, but if you don't have the software to run it, that computer is just minerals. It's just material. And therefore, the argument for evolution has actually eroded and decayed over technology, because technology has done more to prove otherwise that there's just no way we evolved from monkeys, or as J.M. Roberts asserts, that we evolved from rodents. There is an anti-Christian doctrine being taught within the school. So as soon as we can start moving and backing some of those types of things out of our school system, then I'd say, all right, I think we're starting to gain ground here. One of the first things we should do is get rid of the Department of Education as a part of those 12 executive branches that I've talked about. There has been a consistent compromise that has always been done on the conservative side, and the progressives have always been the benefactors, and we have to stop that. We have to turn that around, and the only way to do that, and I think the catalyst behind that, is causing the audit to occur and getting the federal involvement and the federal enforcement of their dogma and doctrine down into the states off. We just cut that off and stop it, because all of the money that the federal government gets is literally coming in via the states. They're just printing money, and then they're backing it through the taxation that they're pulling from us. So there are financial ways that we can actually and really survive much better without the restraints of the federal government. And I can get into that, but I really want to focus on the Constitution and how we can get these things undone. In the very first episode, I talked about the Constitutional Convention and the differences, the self-interest, and all of that type of stuff. And moving forward, and actually even at the time, they were trying to set expectations in the very beginning. And there were some that actually left the Constitutional Convention, such as Rhode Island. The first 5 weeks of that Constitutional Convention was considered the most contentious because they hadn't started praying and hadn't started harmonizing as a body. The other important thing is that they hadn't been able to decide the issue of slavery. And if you read Madison's notes on the convention, it's very apparent that the majority of the states wanted to end and abolish slavery because it harmonized with our Declaration of Independence. Allowing the Republic to maintain slavery was just the antithesis of what they had just fought this revolution for. However, there were three states, the Carolinas and Georgia, that basically said, if you are going to take slavery away from us, then we're leaving this and we won't be any part of it. I believe that was the biggest mistake that they made. And it was the most costly mistake because look at the lives that were affected from that point forward and going into the Civil War and so forth. Had they done it right at the very beginning, we would not have this institutionalized and organizationalized racism or the ability and the facade of being able to throw racist cards out there. So it's a dirty problem that has to be placed into context because as they made this compromise, they also understood that there were going to be consequences to that. And actually Mason's great quote at the time was very heir apparent when he basically said that every slave owner is a petty tyrant and that God cannot punish nations and states in heaven. So he will punish this nation and these states here in this world in our lifetime or in the lifetime to come. And basically he predicted that there would be a civil war and he was right. I can go on and on. There's some really good books that deal with slavery and help change people's minds. But the bottom line is that after they overcame this contention of slavery and said, okay, we'll make that a states' right issue, that the federal government shouldn't even be involved in that, even though in Section 9 of Article 1, they talk about ending the slave trade in 1808, and I talk about this in my book, because Madison was really upset that they entered that. He goes, who's going to be around in 1808 to enforce that? Well, guess who was president in 1808? It was Madison. And guess what was enforced? That. He actually did start that. And it actually started that movement. But anyway, as I want to really try to jump forward, getting past the slavery and getting past our Civil War, the progressives and the liberals have had an old agenda, and that agenda has been the same agenda since the beginning of time, and that is one of slavery. It is a ideology of subjugation. Who are we going to be enslaved to? Are we going to have new slave masters? No, the slave master is the state. The state will compel you to do what is necessary, and I invite anybody to go out and read Plato's Republic. That was the first articulation of communism or statism that was ever pinned to paper. I remember reading Alexander the Great, who had his mentor was Aristotle. He asked Aristotle, why do we keep on going down this path of subjecting ourselves to the state? And Aristotle said, well, that's just how it is because it's the nature of people and it's the nature of my show to be out of time again. And so I will be back next week. Stay tuned and we'll be moving this forward. Thank you. God bless.